down to see their holy bahinis off. Rennie asked hesitantly, "If some of my friends decide to come to Hawaii, girlfriends, that is." She paused. "Sure, I look out for them," Kelly agreed. "You're a darling," she laughed, kissing him ardently as he pulled away to run down the gangplank. In the departure shed, the beach boy, Florsham, they called him that because sometimes he wore shoes, sidled up and asked, "Kelly Blala, dekine wahini, dekine blan, she good screwin'?" "Da bes," Kelly said firmly, and the two beach boys went amiably back to the lagoon. Once or twice as the year 1946 skipped away, Kelly had fleeting doubts which he shared with Florsham. "What's the matter me? Taking care lots of ahini, all mixed up. Where it gonna get me?" But such speculation was always stilled by the arrival of some new divorcee or widow, and the fun of working it around so that he got into bed with them while they paid the hotel and restaurant bills was so great that he invariably came around to Florsham's philosophy. "Mo better we got fun now while we young." So he maintained the routine. Meet the ship, find the girl that someone had cabled about, take her surfing, live with her for 8 days, kiss her goodbye on the Mauna Loa, get some rest, and then meet the next ship. Sometimes he looked with admiration at Johnny Pupali, 49 years old, and still giving the Bahinis what he called Dr. Pupali's surfboard cure for misery. One afternoon he asked Pupali about his surprising energy, and the Dean of Beach Boys explained, "A man got energy for do 4 things, eat, work, surf, or make love. But at one time got stuff for only 2. For me, surfin' and makin' love." "You ever get tired?" Kelly asked. "Surfin'? No. I gonna die on an incoming wave. Bahinis?" "Tell you the truth, Kelly. Sometime for about 10 minutes after Mauna Loa sail, I don't never want to see de kini bahini no mo. But next day, when another ship blow another whistle, man, I'm stripped for action." In the lazy weeks between girls, Kelly found real joy in loafing on the beach with Florsham, a big, sprawling man who wore his own kind of costume. Enormous baggy shorts of silk and cotton that looked like underwear and fell 2 inches below his knees. A tent-like aloha shirt whose ends he tied about his middle, leaving a 4-inch expanse of belly. Japanese slippers with a thong between his toes, and a coconut hat with a narrow brim and 2 long fibers reaching 8 inches in the air and flopping over on one side. Florsham always looked sloppy until he kicked off his clothes and stood forth in skin-tight bathing trunks. And then he looked like a pagan deity, huge, brown, long hair about his ears, and a wreath of fragrant mile encircling his brow. Even the most fastidious mainland women reveled in this transformation and loved to lie on the sand beside him, tracing his rippling muscles with their red fingernails. Kelly preferred Florsham as a companion because the huge beach boy could sing the strange falsetto of the islands, and together they made a gifted pair, for Kelly had a fine baritone voice. He was also skilled at slack key, a system of guitar playing peculiar to Hawaii, in which the strings were specially tuned to produce both plucked melody and strummed chords. Many people thought of Kelly's slack key as the voice of the islands, for when he was in good form, he gave his music an urgent sweetness that no other possessed. The melodies were swift and tremulous like an island bird, but the chords were slow and sure like the thundering of the surf. When the Beach Boys had nothing to do, they often called, "Kelly Blala, play the kini slack key like that." He was their troubadour, but he rarely played for visitors. "I don't like waste time, Howley," he growled. "They don't know slack key." The other pastime that he and Florsham loved was Sakura, a crazy Japanese card game played with little black cards that came in a wooden box with a picture of cherry blossoms on the cover. Any beach boy was hailed as the day's hero who could scrape together enough money to buy a fresh box of Sakura cards, and through the long, hot days, the gang would sit beneath coconut umbrellas playing the silly game. No other was allowed. And if a man couldn't play Sakura, he couldn't be a beach boy. Of course, he must also speak degenerate pidgin, as on the afternoon when Kelly was protesting the price of cube steak at the corner drugstore. Me tink high too much de kinny 50 cent, he mused. Kelly blala, what de kinny you speak? Florsham asked idly. What's the matter, you stupid? You aka my good too much de kinny, Kelly growled, adding with a chopping motion of his right hand, de kinny chop chop. Oh, Florsham sang in a high descending wail of recognition. You speak da kinny. Right, blala, price too much. 50 cent too bloody takai. And they passed to other equally important topics. As Kelly became better acquainted with American girls, he felt sorry for them. Invariably, they confided how wretched their lives had been with their Haole husbands, how the men were not interested in them, and how unsatisfactory sex had been. This latter knowledge always astonished Kelly, for while the girls were with him, they could think of little else. And if the world had women who were better at sex than the Vahinis who came over to Hawaii on the Mauna Loa, he concluded they must be real tigers. One day he told Florsham, how some Vahini gonna be any better than de kinny Vahini we got over here? What you suppose de matter with these Haole men? In 1947 he got a partial answer, because Florsham married one of his young divorcees, a girl who had a lot of money and who gave him a Chevrolet convertible. And as long as they stayed in Hawaii, things went rather well. But after 3 months in New York, they broke all to hell, and Florsham came back alone to resume his job on the beach. On a day when there was little doing, he explained to his companions, "These Vahini, Dakini, seem like they two people. Over here on a surfboard, they relax, they screw like mad, they don't give a damn. Over here, I throw my Vahini in the jalopy and we go a call a how." He steered the imaginary car with his hands. "We have best time." "What happened?" Kelly asked. "I tell you, Kelly Blala," Florsham drawled. "She take me New York. She no like the way I dress. She no like the kinny talk. And she don't like one goddamn ting, I think. All the time, gimme hell. No more time to go bed in the afternoon when it's the best. So by and by she tell me, 'Florsham, you gotta go night school, learn speak Haole no Kanaka.' And I tell him, 'Go to hell, I catch him airplane Hawaii.' And she speak me, 'Why you gonna use money to kinny?' And I tell him, $700 I scoop from you. And she speak, 'You dirty bow, you filthy mountain pig.' And what I tell him then, I ain't gonna repeat." "De kinny Vahini turn out like that?" Johnny Pupali mused. "Well, that's why I tell you, boys, screw 'em, but don't marry 'em." Florsham reflected, "Seem like they good Vahini over here, but another kinny back home." "You gonna keep the kinny Chevy?" Kelly asked. "Yeah," Florsham said, adding, "I not help so sorry for dem Vahini like I was before." The sweet days rolled on, and Kelly discovered what the older beach boys already knew, that the best Vahinis of all were those from the deep south. They were gentler, kinder, and in memorable ways much more loving. They seemed fascinated by Kelly's dark brown body, and on 3 different occasions Kelly stayed for days at a time in one suite or another with some adorable girl from the south, without ever leaving the room, and often without dressing from one day to the next. At mealtime, he would throw a small towel about his waist, tucking in the ends as if it were a sarong, and the Vahini from Montgomery or Atlanta or Birmingham would admire him as he lolled about the Davenport. Once such a girl said, "You're awfully close to a nigra, Kelly, and yet you aren't. It's fascinating." "Hawaiians hate niggers," Kelly assured her, and she felt better. "How do you make your living?" she asked softly, coming to lie beside him after the food had been pushed away. "Suppose I learn you surfing. I get paid." "You get paid for what you did on that surfboard?" she gasped. "What's the matter? You no look you bill? Clerk put him on there." "Do you get paid for days like this?" "Clerk put him on. Rules say I'm supposed teaching you something. That you are, she said softly, as they lapsed off into another nap. In time, the girls he slept with became fused in his memory, for one sent another, who sent another, but they always seemed to be the same girl, someone he had first met during the war. But there were a few whom he remembered forever. Once, a young widow from Baton Rouge flew into the islands, and when he met her, he calculated, "This Vahini, 3 nights to Kinney, maybe 4. He had underestimated, for in her sorrow the young woman would accept no man. Yet, when they stood in her cabin aboard the departing Mauna Loa, she said in a soft southern drawl, "The world is such a goddamned lonely place, Kelly." "S'pose you lose a kin a man you love, I think maybe so," he said. "I never loved Charlie," she confessed, blowing her nose. "But he was a decent man, a good human being, and the world is worse off now that he's gone." "What you gon' do bimeby?" he asked her, lolling with one arm about the end of the bed. "I don't know," she said. "How old are you, Kelly?"
"I 22 last week."
"You have your life ahead of you, Kelly. It should be so exciting. But never kid yourself, Kelly. The world is a very lonely place." "People come, they go," he said philosophically. "But when a good one comes, hold on to the memory. It's almost time for the whistle, and I wonder if I might do one thing before you go."
"What dat?"
Kelly asked suspiciously. "Could I kiss you goodbye? You've been so kind and understanding." She started to say something more, but broke into tears and pressed her beautiful white face to his. "You are such a goddamned decent human being," she whispered. "More than anything in the world, I needed to meet someone like you." Biting her lip and sniffling away her tears, she pushed him back toward the door and said, "Kelly, do you understand even remotely how deeply a woman like me prays for the success of a strong young man like you? I wish the heavens could open and give you their glory. Kelly, make a good life for yourself. Don't be a bum, for you are one of the men whom Jesus loves." And she sent him away. Often, when the surf was breaking, he contemplated her words and wondered how a man went about building a good life for himself. He suspected that it consisted neither in being an old stud horse like Johnny Pupali, fun though that was, nor in wasting one's energies on a Haole wife the way Florsheim had done. Yet all he knew how to do was lie in the sun, play slack key and sakura, and teach Vahinis how to surf. So for the time being, that had to be good enough. In late 1947, however, a nightclub singer from New York arrived in the islands, a 2-night Vahini she turned out to be, and she took such a boisterous joy in Kelly that one night she cried, "God, they ought to build a monument to you, Beach Boy." She was outraged when she learned that the current popular song, "The Rolling Surf," was something that Kelly had composed on the beach and had given away to whoever wanted it. A mainland musician had glommed onto it, added a few professional twists, and made a pile of money from it. "You ought to sue the dirty bastard," she yelled. Later, she tested Kelly's voice and found it good. "Tomorrow night, Kelly Kanakoa, you're going to sing with me in the dining room of the lagoon." "I no like singing," Kelly protested, but she asked, "What's that lovely thing you and the falsetto boy were doing with your ukuleles?" "You speak the Kinney Hawaiian wedding song?" he asked. "The one where you start low and he comes in high?" Casually, Kelly started singing Kekali Ne Au, the greatest of all Hawaiian songs, a glorious, haunting evocation of the islands. At the moment, he was wearing a lagoon towel as a sarong, with a hibiscus flower in his hair. And as he sang, the nightclub girl sensed his full power and cried, "Kelly, nothing can stop you." After one day's rehearsal, for the girl was a real professional and learned quickly, Kelly Kanakoa, dressed in a red and white sarong with one of his mother's whale-tooth hooks dangling from a silver chain about his neck, and with a flower in his hair, came onto the floor of the lagoon and started singing with a voice that was to become famous throughout the islands. The wedding song was unusual in that it provided a powerful solo for a baritone voice and a high, soaring, dreamlike melody for a soprano. It was a true art song, worthy of Schubert or Hugo Wolf. And although that night's audience had heard it often before, sung by blousy baritones and worse sopranos, they had not really heard the full majesty of the lyric outcry. Kelly was a man in love, a muscular, bronzed god, and the slim, blonde girl from New York was in all ways his counterfoil. It was a memorable evening, and as it ended, the singer called to Kelly while he washed down in her shower. "How'd you like to come to New York with me?" "I don't leave Duroc," he called back. "You don't have to marry me," she assured him, aware before he was of his apprehensions. "Just sing." "Me and the beach, we akamai," he said. And although she begged him several more times while they were in bed, he insisted that his place was in Hawaii. "See de kenny what happen Florsham," he repeated. "Well, anyway," she said as she dressed for the plane, "we taught one another a lot in a few days." "You speak de truth," Kelly agreed. "You gonna keep on singing?" she asked. "Scoshy singin', scoshy surfin'." "Don't give up the surfing," she said sardonically. "You got a real good thing working for you there." "Sista, dis Kanaka don't aim to lose it," Kelly laughed. "I'm sure you don't," she cracked. She was brassy, and her hair was dark at the roots, but she was a good, clean companion, and Kelly appreciated her. "I ain't able come out to the airport," he said apologetically. "You took care of things here," she assured him, patting the bed, "and that's where it counts." Then, in early 1948, when the tourist business was beginning to boom, he received a cable from some Vahini in Boston named Rennie, but he couldn't remember who she was. "But anyway," she said, "meet Mauna Loa Mrs. Dale Henderson." And when the ship came in, Florsham, barefooted and staring up at the railing, asked, "Which one you Vahini, Kelly Blala?" "Maybe de kinny," he indicated with a shrug of his shoulder. "You s'pose she gonna lay?" Florsham asked, appraising the slim, handsomely groomed girl, who appeared to be in her early 30s. "She looked maybe 2 nights, maybe 4, Kelly calculated, for he had found that women who spent unusual care on their appearance were often more tardy in climbing into bed than their sisters who called to the world, "Here I am, wind-blown and happy." Kelly, who, like the other beach boys, was privileged to climb aboard the Mauna Loa before disembarkation started, elbowed his way along the crowded deck and touched Mrs. Henderson on the arm. She turned and smiled at him, a clean, unconfused greeting. When he shook hands with her, he asked, "You name Dale or something else? Seem like nobody can't speak man's name, woman's name no more." "My name is Mrs. Henderson, Eleanor Henderson," she replied in the crisp and self-possessed voice of a New Englander. "I'm from Boston." Kelly very much wanted to ask, "Who dis Rennie Vahini cable me? I no remember nobody in Boston." But he didn't speak. One rule he had learned in his beach boy business, never mention one woman to another. So that, even though most of the customers he met had been referred to him by others, often intimate friends, he never mentioned that fact. Culling his brain furiously, he still failed to recall who Rennie was, and he did not refer to her cable. But Mrs. Henderson did. "A college classmate of mine at Smith." "Dat don't sound like no Vahini college, Smith." "Rennie Blackwell. She told me to be sure to look you up." Quickly, Kelly composed his face as if he knew well who Rennie Blackwell was. And just as quickly, Mrs. Henderson thought, "After all she told me, and he doesn't even remember her name." Wanting perversely to explore the situation further, she added, "Rennie was the girl from Tulsa." Still, Kelly could not place her among the nameless girls that populated his life. And now he was aware that Mrs. Henderson was playing a game with him, so he lapsed into his most barbarous pigeon and banged his head with his fist. Sometime I no akamai de kine, dis vahini reni I not collect. Mrs. Henderson smiled and said, "She collects you, Kelly." He was irritated with this secure woman and said, "Spose 1 year pass, bime by I say Florsham, cable here speak Eleanor Henderson, who dat one bahini? Florsham, he don't collect, I don't collect." "Who's Florsham?" Eleanor asked. "De Kinney beach boy yonder alongside tall bahini," Kelly explained. Mrs. Henderson laughed merrily and said, "Rennie told me you were the best beach boy in the business, but you must promise me one thing."
"What dat?"
"You aren't required to talk pigeon to me any longer. I'll bet you graduated with honors from Hewlett Hall. You can probably speak English better than I can." She smiled warmly and asked, "Aren't you going to give me the lay?" "I'm afraid to kiss you, Mrs. Henderson," he laughed, and handed her the flowers. But Florsham saw this and rushed up, protesting, "Jesus Christ, Kanaka handin' bahini flowers like New York?" He grabbed the lei, plopped it around Eleanor's head, and kissed her powerfully. "Florsham's been in New York," Kelly joked. "He knows how to act like a Hawaiian."
"Florsham in New York?"
Mrs. Henderson reflected, studying the huge beach boy with the long hair and the wreath of mile leaves. "I'll bet the city'll never be the same." "He married a society girl," Kelly explained. "Stayed with her 3 months and came back. He got a Chevy convertible out of it. In fact, we're riding back to the hotel in it." At this point, Florsham's girl from Kansas City hustled up, heavy with leis and mascara, and giggled, "My God, aren't these men positively divine?" She grabbed Florsham's dark brown arm, felt the muscles admiringly, and asked, "You ever hit a man with that fist, Florsham?"
"Never," the beach boy replied. "Only women."
His girl laughed outrageously, and when the various bits of luggage were piled into the Chevy, the two couples headed for the lagoon. But when Florsham drove up King Street and passed the old mission houses, Eleanor Henderson abruptly asked him to stop, and she studied the historic buildings carefully, explaining at last, "My great-great-grandmother was born in that house. Originally, I was a Quigley."
"Never heard of them," Kelly said honestly.
"They didn't stay long, but I'm doing a biography of them for my thesis. I teach at Smith, you know."
"You da kinny vahini bime by gonna write a book?"
Florsham asked as he resumed the trip. "Tell him he doesn't have to talk pigeon," Eleanor suggested.
"He can't talk anything else," Kelly.